morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, April 23rd, is William Shakespeare's 456th birthday. Or it presumably might be on the basis that he was baptized on April 26th, 1564, the usual custom generally 3 days after birth, which, if so, the great bard died exactly 52 years later on this same date in 1616. As Ben Jonson wrote posthumously of Shakespeare in 1623 in the famous First Folio, a collection of Willie the Shake's plays and a justly credited prescience that he was not of an age, but for all time, quote, unquote. Shakespeare immortally reflected that paradox of mortality in the renowned soliloquy by his star-crossed prince, Hamlet. To be or not to be, that is the question. Perhaps in our current star-crossed era, the question might be more pertinently modified. To continue to be or to not continue to be, that is the real question this plague year. Other parts of Hamlet's monological discursion with a skull are apt to this novel moment, such as the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune, and the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. These long time ago words redound as we hobbitize like hobbits in our own private habitats, waiting out the melodious passage of plague and peccadillic pressure from dystopian avarice that we forfeit our safety and perhaps our lives for a diseased status quo of wealth and commerce most of us never share equitably, only parsimoniously. Today's program is primarily about the pandemic that foreshadows our grasp of mortality. I culled its parts out of the air wirelessly, so to speak. Two articles digital expressed across the cybernetic spaces by the New York Times. Does the pandemic have a purpose? And how starfish, snails, and salmon fight pandemics. I dedicate today's radio rant to the entire crisis medical and health vocation, and two Oregon registered nurses in particular, female sisters whom I have known since they were children, Tony and Jamie Linton, both now married and each the mother of a girl and boy. Tony is a respiratory nurse. Jamie is a maternity nurse. They are of mixed blood, black, white, and Pacific Island Asian. Their father, James Linton, was a Vietnam veteran who survived the siege of Khe Sanh, but not an auto accident 20 years later, the major killer of humans. As prelude to the articles I am about to read, a quote from George Whitmore, a victim of the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, who quoted George Meredith's Dirge in Woods, "And we go, and we drop like the fruits of the tree, even we, even so." Does the Pandemic Have a Purpose? By Stephen T. Asma. With a slug on it, only if we give it one. The coronavirus is neither good nor bad. It wants only to reproduce. And Stephen Asma is a professor of philosophy and an author. Nature doesn't care about you. That may seem harsh, but strictly speaking, nature doesn't care about anyone or anything except passing genes into the next generation. We know this if we've studied evolution. It was Darwin's great achievement to explain the adaptation of organisms without appeal to God's design or mystical idealism. Darwinian evolution is true, corroborated by mountains of evidence, but it's also a cold metaphysics. The biologist Stephen Jay Gould described it as a cold bath view of nature, not warm and fuzzy in the way religion characterizes nature. Reflect for a moment the rhizocephala, or root-headed barnacle, which lives lives its life feeding inside crabs and other crustaceans. It gets inside the crab as a seed and begins to spread throughout the host in a series of complex root systems, often infiltrating, like a creeping vine, every limb of the crab. This root system castrates its host, preventing the crab's continuation of gene line, stops the crab's molting cycle, and keeps it alive, all the while feeding off of it for years. Or consider the tarantula hawk, a giant wasp that hunts tarantulas as a food supply for its larvae. The wasp paralyzes a tarantula with its powerful sting and lays an egg on the spider's paralyzed body. When the wasp larva hatches out, it feeds slowly on the still-living tarantula, even carefully avoiding at first the consumption of working vital organs to guarantee extended freshness. Not even the most inventive Hollywood writers can spin tales this fantastic, yet it is the bread and butter of everyday biology. Should we thank the E. coli in our guts that help us to digest? Should we alternatively fault the virus that is breaking down our immune systems and spreading through the host population? These organisms are not evil or noble, intentionally wreaking havoc on our health. They are simply doing what comes naturally, surviving and reproducing. This is not meant to sound callous or insensitive. It's obvious that our struggle with other organisms matters a great deal to us, causing real despair and tragedy. But from the more general evolutionary perspective, this drama is value neutral. Strictly speaking, it isn't even a drama because there is no plot in nature. Many religious people see something benevolent in nature, or at least see purpose dimly grasped in the interworking of biology. But there's something even deeper than religious optimism. There is a broader conception of nature, shared by monotheists, polytheists, indigenous animists, and now politicians and policymakers. It is the mythopoetic view of nature. It is the universal instinct to find, or project, a plot in nature. A mythopoetic paradigm or perspective sees the world primarily as a dramatic story of competing personal intentions rather than a system of objective impersonal laws. It is a pre-scientific worldview, but it is also alive and well in the contemporary mind. President Donald Trump, for example, has described the coronavirus as our great enemy in an all-out war, saying, quote, "the virus will not have a chance against us," unquote. And a few weeks later, quote, "we will win this war," unquote. But strictly speaking, wars are fought against malicious agents, people who mean you harm. The coronavirus is like every other virus or pathogen. It does not mean us harm. It wants only to reproduce. After Darwin, we see that nature can be horrifying, but not evil, nor good. When Mr. Trump puts a moral frame on the spreading virus, he interprets it in a mythopoetic manner, and we clearly understand him because we too apply the mythopoetic frame easily and naturally. If we must frame this in terms of politics, the left is just as mythopoetic as the right. I have heard many liberal commentators lately moralize on the grounds that our encroachment on pristine nature and our environmental sins have brought the zoonotic spillover as nature's retribution. The left, proposing a mythopoetic tragedy of hubris, suggests that we brought this upon ourselves. Pope Francis suggested that pandemics may be nature's retaliation for human abuse of the environment. "I don't know if these are the revenge of nature," he said, "but they are certainly nature's responses." In reality, zoonotic spillover, parasitism, predation, extinction are not punishments at all, but business as usual. They have always been here and always will be. Most of the known pathogens that infect humans have zoonotic origins, and human abuse of the environment is not their principal cause. Most spillover and transmission result from our domestication of animals, the adaption of animals, e.g., rodents, to our urban environments, and the unprecedented human mixing of urbanization. Disease and death are not bugs in the system, but features. In fact, the cold bath truth is that natural selection works only because many more organisms are born than can survive to procreate. Natural selection is not malevolent, but is clearly not benevolent either. Against the frightening neutrality of nature, we humans marshal the powerful imagination, imagining that we are in a species-wide war with a biblical-style evil enemy may be factually absurd, but I recommend we embrace this powerful fiction anyway. We evolve to capture and clarify our experience in mythic stories, plots with good guys and bad guys. We draw upon the Force. We pray for divine intercession. We try to get in harmony with the Tao, enlist the Dharma, forge good karma, make sacrifices to purify ourselves, Ramadan, Lent, Yom Kippur, and generally try to turn nature and destiny to our benefit. How could we do otherwise? The stakes are the survival of our very kin. The more vulnerable we are, the more our mythopoetic imagination comes to the fore. Medicine and science will hopefully find a vaccine, but for those of us who don't have research labs, imagination can aid in the battle. Imagining that we are at war with an enemy will help us make the difficult personal sacrifices, like social distancing and sheltering in place, that go beyond our own egoistic hedonism. Imagining that the sins of our failed environmentalism have brought nature's vengeance will help us prepare better for the future and course correct our environmental policies. Personifying nature can be adaptive and beneficial. Imagining our lives as a dramatic struggle with occasional enemies, microscopic and macroscopic, can help us change hearts and minds, embolden convictions, inspire sacrifice, and thereby change the actual outcome of epidemics and other trials and tribulations. But mythopoetic views of disasters like this one are easily influenced by charismatic leaders, formerly shamans and priests, now presidents and politicians. The enemy we war against gets personified into an ethnic group for scapegoating. So let us put our faith in science and give our gratitude to healthcare workers, but let us also use our imaginations carefully and responsibly so that the denouement of this story is eventually a human victory, not just a national or political one. Some might argue that a human victory is not what's needed here, that the neutrality of nature, free of concepts of good and evil, obviates a winner or loser. That may be true if we view it from a distance, but in the thick of it, the imperative of our genetic survival remains. It is our unique Darwinian legacy. As a naturalist, I resist the theological version of human exceptionalism, but as a philosopher, I'm inclined to recognize that nothing has intrinsic value until we humans imagine it so. Since we cannot find our species' value objectively by looking at the neutral laws of nature, then we must just assert it and simply affirm that the universe is more remarkable with us in it. And that was Does the Pandemic Have a Purpose? By Stephen Asma, who is professor of philosophy at Columbia College, Chicago, and a member of the Public Theologies of Technology and Presence program at the Institute of Buddhist Studies. He is a co-author of The Emotional Mind, The Effective Roots of Culture and Cognition. And now, by C. Drew Harville, How Starfish, Snails, and Salmon Fight Pandemics. Friday Harbor, Washington. 6 years ago, I began investigating starfish dying by the millions off the west coast of the United States from a mysterious wasting disease. The deaths continue. More than 20 species of starfish have been hit. These predators are important to the health of kelp forests, and their demise has thinned or destroyed these places and their bountiful biodiversity. A virus is believed to be the cause. Before that, I saw corals on reefs of the Yucatan, Australia, and Palau dissolve from the spread of infectious bacterial diseases. Right now, Caribbean corals are under siege from what scientists think is a deadly, highly contagious microbial pathogen. As a marine biologist who studies disease outbreaks in the ocean, I am no stranger to pandemics. I have seen the devastation pathogens cause and how it is amplified as the oceans warm. But I have also seen the remarkable adaptations that creatures like starfish, corals, and abalones develop against these threats and the defenses they deploy. Like humans, they are resilient and immunologically cunning in ways we are continuing to discover. Now the world is seeing the deadly path cut by a terrestrial pandemic, spread by a new coronavirus that has killed tens of thousands of people worldwide as it continues its sweep. If anything good is to emerge from this, it will be in the quest to better understanding pathogens and their hosts, to find nature's best defenses, and to apply these findings to engineer a safer world. The sea is a good place to start. Right now, we are investigating whether some natural ocean habitats have superpowers to fight disease. In the tropical waters of Indonesia, our team has measured a 50% reduction of pathogenic bacteria and coral diseases in meadows of seagrass. These pathogenic bacteria originated in human sewage and make both people and wildlife sick. We are replicating this environment in the urban waters of the Puget Sound to discover what special powers seagrass meadows contain that reduce pathogens. Vigorous production of oxygen by these underwater plants is certainly one line of defense, but we are also investigating how the microbiomes of seagrasses can regulate health. Imagine if one day we could extract a critical defense against pathogens hidden in these seagrass meadows to use in medicines or diets. The oceans have long been a source of new antimicrobial agents and anti-cancer drugs like trabectedin from Caribbean and Florida mangrove sea squirts for liposarcoma and carrageenan from algae to disrupt herpes and influenza viruses. We might benefit right away if we discover that humans living near seagrass meadows are more protected from deadly bacterial pollutants common in human sewage. We might also know that corals living in protected areas of ocean with better functioning, more intact food systems have lower rates of disease. By preserving the intricacies of these ecosystems, we may be able to stop pathogens in their tracks, a lesson that can be applied to ecosystems where humans roam. Scientists continue to study the epidemic that has struck starfish in the Pacific and has pushed one species, the once common sunflower starfish, to endangerment. But another starfish, the intertidal okra sea star, is holding its own. Researchers are trying to figure out whether it is developing resistance and how. And consider the abalone, a marine snail with blue blood that fights viruses. The protein that gives the blood its color can control cold sores and herpes through a newly discovered mechanism that blocks entry into cells by the herpes simplex virus. We are now seeing a recently discovered coronavirus infecting salmon in the Salish Sea off southern British Columbia and northern Washington. It is in the same group of coronaviruses as the one that causes COVID-19 and those that cause MERS and SARS. It attacks the gills, so in this way is similar to the respiratory diseases caused by related mammalian coronaviruses. It has been named Pacific Salmon Nidovirus. More research into this pathogen's spread and the defense mounted by its salmon hosts might offer us additional insights into how coronaviruses function and how we can curb their spread in nature and, in turn, reduce human infections. These examples give me hope that we can find new ways to help protect us against the emergence of diseases. To do this, we need to figure out how pathogen-fighting processes work in nature. We missed our chance to control the coronavirus pandemic at the beginning. The virus spectacularly evaded our best technology, and for now, has reduced the planet's most advanced species to fighting it by social distancing and hiding in our homes. We will eventually prevail with testing and vaccines, but the current triumph of this virus is a searing message to our cavalier species. Going forward, let's focus on doing the basic science to understand what led to the emergence of this pathogen and use scientific understanding and technology to help protect us from these perils. We need to pay more attention to the spread of infectious disease in wild animals and plants, unlocking the secrets of those outbreaks on land and in the sea will help protect the planet's biodiversity and perhaps save us from another pandemic. And that was How Starfish, Snails, and Salmon Fight Pandemics by C. Drew Harville, who is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell University and the author of Ocean Outbreak, Confronting the Rising Tide of Marine Disease. And now, 2 days and 31 years ago, a fire in a house in which I rented a basement apartment in Astoria's Bond Street Historical Slum District incinerated its accidental arsonists and made homeless two elderly women and myself. That was in 1989, April 25th to be specific, and it occurred coincidentally amidst a rain of fire by a real arsonist who terrorized Astoria for several months, purposely igniting 20 fires at least, one of which was the home of KMUN's beloved Sister Pat McCann. The arsonist frightened Astoria so badly that for months the city froze at the sound of a siren, haunted also by memories of the great Astoria fire that burned out Astoria's heart just before Christmas 1922. I wrote a poem about the fire that torched the house I lived in, which I dedicated to its hapless igniter, Coleman Schleiss. Bond Street Farewell. A man, bleak in a dying night, ignites and burns in a chair in the manner of old Buddhist monks, unlike gas poured upon flesh to inflame self-immolation. His fuel is rapidly evaporating alcohol, boiling out through veins and tissue. A cigarette set him afire, small cylinder of menace, which would have got him anyway in slow oxidation, this early spring morning blossoming in spontaneous combustion. His crematorium is an old house in which dwell two elderly ladies who flee his pyre in fear and tears, a brother who shares the attic and flings his mortal life out a window, escaping, unaware of sibling incineration, and in the basement, another man who quit cigarettes a decade before, a monk suddenly awakened and driven from his cell by shouts to get out of hell. A halo of fire crowns his shock as he steps outside his door into the morning before dawn. And that was a poem I wrote, Bond Street Farewell. This is Michael McCusker. Yesterday was Earth Day's 50th anniversary. Today is day one of its 51st year, which includes a crucial date, the November 10th presidential election, and necessary overthrow and disembowelment of nefarious Trumpism, which has threatened world survival more menacingly than coronavirus. But beware, his last months in the White House might very well be catastrophic, perhaps even thermonuclear. Shakespeare posited a warning of sorts about languished spirits in the coming drama, speaking through that same luckless Prince Hamlet intoning to the figurative skull. Thus does conscience make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the paled cast of thought and enterprises of great pitch and moment. With this regard, their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. And that was Shakespeare. And in the meantime, stay safe and And remember that protecting yourselves in this plague period protects everybody else also.